her future and wish every child matters?
Just a day of reflection, honestly. A day to take time out of our normal lives to think about these things and reflect on the past and think about what we need to do to move forward as a country.
Over the 19th and 20th centuries, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were separated from their families and cultures and placed into residential schools. Many suffered abuse and some never returned. It's part of a process the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has called a cultural genocide. Its impacts are still being felt today.
A lot of our people went through that at residential schools or 60 Scoop or and women who had their tubes tied without their consent. That's what was going on in this country, and people need to know. People that are turning a blind eye to that, they want to say, that's the past, forget about the past. No, the past is present.
Jeff Hewitt was among the thousands of marchers out on Tuesday. He told CKUT he was happy to see so many people out in the streets and felt hopeful that things were moving in the right direction.
I see a lot of our people now, a lot of our reserves are getting more control over our children. And not having to put our children in the foster care or the foster system of non-Indigenous people. So that's a big move to have our people raise our children.
That's especially important for Ewart. As a survivor of the 60 Scoop, he didn't go to a residential school, but was taken from his home and placed with a white family.
And I was lost. I didn't know where I was from. I didn't know who I was. What's happening today with these communities that, you know, that are allowed now, it feels funny saying that, but they're allowed to raise their own children, is a beautiful thing, because these children are going to be grounded, they're going to know who they are, and they're not going to be lost, and they're not going to end up in trouble like a lot of our people do.
But not everyone was feeling optimistic about the march.
There's a big discrepancy between answering the call to actions by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and there's a lot of heel dragging from the government as well as citizens of Canada.
Sali attends the march every year with his camera and his drum, but he said this year's march felt smaller than in years previous, and accompanied by a feeling that not much is changing.
These are very, very small incremental changes that pose real, no significant change in our daily lives.
It's been a decade since the Truth and Reconciliation Commission released their final report. Of their 94 calls to action, only 15 have been implemented. The Yellowhead Institute, an Indigenous think tank based out of Toronto, stopped tracking the progress of the calls to action in 2023, after a year where no new calls were implemented. For marchers like Alessia and Linda, that reality is depressing, but it's also what keeps them coming into the streets year after year.
I mean, it's not a reason to lose hope and give up. That's what they want, right? That's what the people who are not taking this seriously want. They want people to lose hope and stop caring and stop taking action. We can say that about many things, but we have to continue to remind ourselves that, like, change happens like at a small scale. Each individual has to do their part. So together we make change.
Yeah,
basically.
It's like a way to fight apathy as well.
Yeah.
I think it's great to find ourselves in community of people who care.
Yeah.
We will never allow the erasure of our people from this country's history.
For CKUT, I'm Jules Bouchel with the Local Journalism Initiative.
Next, we have Ryan Funk from U-Radio in Winnipeg.
This community update was brought to you by U-Radio. It was not a quiet moment, but one filled with reflection, unity, and determination. At the Odena Circle at the Forks, thousands gathered on the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, chanting Every Child Matters, a call to acknowledge Canada's painful history while committing to a more just tomorrow.
Every child matters! Ngwecha Bazindaoyeg to all the young Nietzsche's out there. Grow your hair long, make your mind strong, make your spirit strong, make your body strong.
Premier Wapkinu addressed the crowd, noting that continued community presence and advocacy are what ultimately led to September 30th being recognized as a statutory day of remembrance. Change has happened, but advocates continue to impress upon the urgent needs of Indigenous communities, including housing and addiction services. The Mamawichi Ita Center is one such organization that aims to address these needs. Marion McKenzie is the program support manager at Mamawi.
We're considered the grandmother of the North End because of the work we've been doing. And we started doing this work because of inequities in our community. And, you know, it began with the loss of a child. In the child, while in the care of the child welfare system, and a group of advocates came together and said, enough is enough. And so when they came together, they made a decision that they wanted to have a bigger voice and be leaders in change.
For 40 years, the Mamawi Center has strived to create that change. McKenzie stated that progress is being made, albeit slowly.
We believe that things are changing. They are just slow, but change does happen slowly. And if we want meaningful change to happen, we don't want to rush it either.
Decades ago, Indigenous voices were excluded. Today, those voices are no longer at the back of the room, said McKenzie, but are a part of the decision-making process.
And I believe that people are listening to us, that this is the best way to answer all the calls that are in those 94 calls to action, is to do those things with us as Indigenous people and those of us that have those relationships, those trusted relationships with the communities that need to see action and need systems to change so that they can live good lives and healthy lives.
The Mamawichi Ita Center has identified housing, food security, and mental health as the most pressing challenges facing Indigenous communities. McKenzie emphasized that these are not merely social issues, but structural inequities rooted in colonization and perpetuated through modern systems.
I don't understand how we can be okay with this being such an epidemic for this many years and seeing this to be something that seems to be getting worse before it's getting better. It's not to say that we don't have things happening to try and address it. We absolutely are. Many people are, you know, on those front lines trying to address these issues, but it just takes a lot of people being at the table.
McKenzie reiterated the importance of collaboration and noted that for many Indigenous communities, culture plays a vital role in the healing process.
First and foremost, we always incorporate culture and connection, and reconnection to community and culture is always number one, because there's that loss of connection, especially being in an urban center. There's the loss of connection to community and loss of connection to culture. So we do everything we can to promote that.
As the crowds dispersed on September 30th across the province, the message was clear that reconciliation is not a single day, but a collective and ongoing journey. Those who are non-Indigenous should educate themselves about the history of residential schools, the 94 calls to action, and how to implement them. With You Multicultural and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ryan Funk.
Once again, thank you to Ryan Funk for that piece. We're going to be moving on to Liverpool, Nova Scotia. This is a segment on Truth and Reconciliation Day in Liverpool from Rick Conrad from CJQC.
This is your QCCR news update. I'm Rick Conrad. Hundreds turned out to the Hank Snow Museum Community Park in Liverpool on Tuesday to mark the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation. Survivors of residential schools and their families shared their stories. It was also a social and cultural event highlighting Indigenous dancing, drum singing, and traditional crafts. Here are some of the stories and sounds from the day.
Michelle Roy, and I'm from Wissahoba First Nations. I'm from Queens County. Today's event is about the stories and truth behind residential schools and part of the calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation. And it's about bringing people together, learning you know, the more we know, the better we do. And we're going to have a Maui Omi and share our ways and our dancing and our music with everyone. Thank you for joining us today. Before we do anything, we are going to open with a prayer first. And Elder Alan Knockwood is going to do this for us.
Clay. In Delaware City, Al Knockwood. Nekamagi, Kaya, Muin. Great Spirit.
The best way to learn and learn different language and culture and the Mi'kmaq ways is to come and be with us within our communities and learn from us that way.
The truth of the residential schools across Canada is horrible. A couple years ago, we heard of 215 unmarked graves in Kamloops, British Columbia. We have 137 missing children from Shibonacadie. We have stories from the community of how they disposed of those souls in the furnaces, in the pig farm behind, in that tidal river they call the Shibonacadie River. When I entered Shibonacadie, I spoke Ilnuik to Buzzard. Ilnuisi, huh? Now, at 72, I cannot talk in whole sentences in Nigama. Nestiman Ilnuikto, Amaja. Mezi. I got stuck. I got stuck because I still wait for that strap to hit me. At 72, I'm still waiting for that strap to hit me. They almost killed me there. I almost became 138.
My name is Terry Doucette. I'm here with my wife. I have a long history in the school system. Very, very powerful stories. If it doesn't move your heart to recognize the pain that a lot of people have gone through for generations, you need to check your pulse. It's time for change.
Maggie Roy. Well, I'm actually part of the Mi'kma'ki family here. Yeah, I mean, coming from the culture, it's not surprising. My great-grandmother was in the same boat, residential schools, and then got stripped of her status because she married a white man. For me, it's normal to hear these stories because I grew up around them, but just to see everyone out and wanting to know more and what they can do for change is kind of amazing.
It's really important to me for us to share our culture. The waterway that is the Mersey River is our waterway, our original highway. So it is so rich in artifacts, especially in Queens County. This is important to where I've been born and raised for us to host an important event like this that we don't normally see.
That's your QCCR News Update brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative. For more Queens County news, please visit qccrfm.com/news. I'm Rick Conrad.
Thank you again to Rick Conrad, and we are going to be moving on to the Comox Valley in BC on Vancouver Island. This is a piece with CHLY and CVOX from Heather Watson.
This is a CHLY and Dig FM news update. Tuesday, September 30th is Truth and Reconciliation Day in Canada, instituted for the, quote, public commemoration of the tragic and painful history and ongoing impacts of residential schools, end quote. On September 25th, Comox Valley's local governments shared a joint statement recognizing the day and listing facilities across the city of Courtney, Township of Comox, Village of Cumberland, and the Comox Valley Regional District that will be closed in observance. The four local governments are encouraging residents to acknowledge the day, also recognized as Orange Shirt Day, by wearing orange and participating in the Comox Valley Spirit Walk on Tuesday morning. The Spirit Walk will begin at 10 a.m. at Harmston Park in Courtney and proceed down 5th Street to Lewis Park. The event is organized by the Mikisew Métis Association, Wachier Friendship Center, Indigenous Women's Sharing Society, and Upper Island Women of Native Ancestry. The organizers have the support of Comox First Nation, whose unceded traditional territory the event will be held on. Ramona Johnson of Comox First Nation will speak at the opening of the Spirit Walk. This is the fifth year a walk has been held in Courtney to honor Truth and Reconciliation Day, showing respect to residential school survivors and their families, and educating the community on the history of residential schools in Canada and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In past years, the walks have been self-guided tours of downtown Courtney, following a map to storefronts around town with large informational posters in their windows. Chris Sample, Vice President of the Comox Valley Mikisew Métis Association, shares why the Spirit Walk will be different this year.
This way we did change it up because we thought a sense of community can be enabled more by us walking shoulder to shoulder, all of us walking down the street in our orange shirt. And, you know, in the past, we've had between 1,000 and 1,400 people. So I think that can be kind of impressive.
This year, the Comox Valley Art Gallery is also participating by dedicating a window display to Truth and Reconciliation Day and the Spirit Walk, with diverse cultural elements included from each of the organizing partners and Comox First Nation. The display will be up from September 26th to October 6th. Chris Sample says that on an individual level, the best way to acknowledge Truth and Reconciliation Day is by joining the Spirit Walk.
What they can do is just show up. And Courtney Comox has a great number of people that do show up, honestly. I feel so happy about that because so many people come, so many people are interested in learning about our culture, what went on. I really do think that we're moving in a positive direction, honestly.
The Comox Valley Spirit Walk will begin at 10 a.m. on September 30th at Harmston Park in downtown Courtney. Canadian Heritage encourages all Canadians to wear orange on September 30th, quote, to honor the thousands of survivors of residential schools, end quote. For Dig FM and CHLY News, this is Heather Watson.
This report in partnership with Dig FM was made possible with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs program, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Okay, we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here is the last piece that I'll be playing for the hour. This comes from Oswekin, Ontario, from Andrew Dow, from CJKS. This is a piece about a former residential school becoming a new historical museum in the area. And that was unveiled on National Day of Truth and Reconciliation.
September 30th marks Orange Shirt Day, a day to honor residential school survivors and remember the children who never made it home as part of Canada's Indian residential school system. And this year, the Woodland Cultural Center will mark the day with a special event and the reopening of the former Mohawk Institute as a historical museum. So joining us to talk about the significance of the day and what visitors can expect is Heather George, Executive Director of the Woodland Cultural Center. So thank you for taking some time today, Heather.
You're so welcome.
And so this year, Woodland is marking Orange Shirt Day with a very significant step with the reopening of the former Mohawk Institute. Can you tell us about what all is planned for September 30th and what visitors can expect?
For sure. So we are opening the front gates around 9 o'clock and speeches start around 10. So from about 10 till 10:45, we have a series of different speakers, including some of the survivors from the Mohawk Institute. And then for the rest of the day, the building is open on hourly self-guided tours, and folks can just come on the day and get a bracelet for a specific time, and they can go through the building. We're expecting a large number of people, about 3,000 people. So we do want to let people know that if they aren't in the very first group into the building, that they don't need to worry because there's also other programming. We have film showings. We have survivor panels. We're also officially releasing Rick Hill's new book, Behind the Brick. And we also have some art programming on the site. And it's the last day for the Indigenous Arts Exhibition. So there's lots of other things that people can do while they're waiting to get into the building.
And just talking about all the work that's been put into this, how does it feel to be opening the doors to the public?
a little bit tiring, to be honest, but I'm really glad that we're at this point. Really, when I think about it and reflect on it, I'm just so, so grateful that the community and that the survivors decided that it was important to keep this building, and that all of the staff and the donors and survivors have supported this process of construction over the last decade, because it's been such a long project and a challenging project in lots of different ways. So a mix of tiredness and also a lot of gratitude.
And what are some of the things that you hope visitors can take away when they walk through those doors next Tuesday?
I think the most powerful part of the interpretation is that the voice of survivors is in the building. So it's through audio listening stations, but there's also quotes everywhere throughout the building, on the steps, on the desks, on tables, on walls. And those are all direct quotes from survivors from the work that Rick Hill did interviewing them. And I think that that's the most powerful part of the building now, is actually hearing from them what they experienced while they were here. And I think it'll be hard for people. It can be really hard to be in the space. It can be upsetting. There's a lot of emotion tied to it. It can also make people pretty angry. It makes me angry sometimes, but I hope that they will also have some hope and compassion for each other and for survivors, and that this is never forgotten, that the history of residential schools and what our family members went through is never forgotten.
And working with the survivors throughout this reopening process, have you been able to get feedback from them on it and just what their feelings are being able to be a part of that process?
I think the thing that stands out to me the most, which really, you know, struck me about survivors being in the building, and I think probably they're still processing too. It is a lot of change. It looks a lot different. But the simple act of putting a doorway back in the front hallway between the Indian visiting room and what was the headmaster's office. And Diane told me how important that was to her and how much it meant to her. And from a construction perspective, that's probably one of the easiest things we've done. But that doorway was so important and tied to her memories and the loss that she experienced as a child here. And so it reminded me how much of the physical presence of this building is important to survivors. And I'm really glad that we were able to do that.
And with the event growing year over year and bringing not only Six Nations community members, but also a broader audience to the cultural center as well, what's the importance in not having just Six Nations community attending, but also that group of people in attendance to learn about the history of the Mohawk Institute as well?
I really think that, you know, we all talk about truth and reconciliation, and it has truth first. And I think we're very much still in the truth-telling phase for us as Indigenous community members and, you know, family of survivors and for the survivors. It's this project and this reopening of the building, I think it provides that opportunity to ensure that people experience the truth in the place that it happened. And I hope that it doesn't just sort of capture their minds, but also their hearts. Because I think part of the challenge of reconciliation is that we are sort of expecting non-Indigenous people to do it because it's a good thing to do and it's the right thing to do. But I think until people really feel it emotionally, sometimes they have a hard time prioritizing it amongst all the other things that they're doing in their lives. And I honestly think that good nations can teach their good history and their bad history. And so Canada needs to be able to face that it has a history of genocide, and all Canadians need to know that history.
And just for anyone in attendance, is there a message that you hope people can leave the grounds with?
I hope they leave the grounds with the understanding that this is a start, that coming here is sort of bearing witness to this history is sort of a first action, and that there's so much more work that needs to be done around the 94 calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's the 10th anniversary of that report this year, and we've only accomplished 15 of those calls to action. And so I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to lobby politicians and make them understand at all levels of government that this is something that is important to Canadian citizens and that they need to support Indigenous communities' well-being and the work of healing.
And just lastly, Heather, how can people who can't attend in person still support or learn about the Woodland Cultural Center, the Mohawk Institute, and anything else that you guys have going on right now?
For sure. So if people can't come in person, I mean, we're open 50 weeks out of the year. So it's certainly, you know, make a plan to come here eventually. We're open every day except Monday from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. But we also do virtual programming. So once a month, we usually run like a virtual tour or a lunch and learn. So you just have to pay attention to our social media posts for that. But also, I think it's a really great way if you want to get together with like a group of your friends or your coworkers or say like your community organization or church group, and we can host virtual programs for any group. They just have to contact us and book that. And the same if people want to come on a group tour, they just reach out to Woodland and we can book group tours as well. I think it's really powerful to do this work with other people so that you have someone to talk to, you have other people who are having the experience with you.
All right, Heather, thank you again for doing this and best of luck with the event happening next Tuesday. And definitely looking forward to seeing everything that's planned for such an important day.
Thank you so much.
I'm Andrew Dow, and this news story is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, which supports the creation of original civic news.
All right. Thank you to Andrew Dow for that segment. And we have reached the very end of this hour of Speak Up. Thank you for tuning in this week. Make sure you come back on Thursday at 10 a.m. for another episode of Speak Up. Wednesdays as well, we have Intravenous, so make sure you stay tuned for that. And coming up in about 4 minutes now, we have Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, a long-standing show that does not only air here, but airs on many other community radio stations. So make sure you stay tuned for all of the amazing programming we have for today and this week. I'm going to be ending off this hour with a track from John Bentley. This one's titled, Go Ahead.